The company's British officers were often of poor quality, for the abler and more thrusting among them sought secondment to the more spacious fields of civil administration. Many of those who remained at regimental headquarters were out of touch with their men and showed no desire to improve matters. Troops were needed for a war with Burma, but if they crossed the high seas, they lost caste. Dalhousie nevertheless made recruits liable for service anywhere in the world. There were grievances about pay and pensions. Other developments, unconnected with this military unrest, added their weight. By the 1850s, railways, roads, posts, telegraphs, and schools were beginning to push and agitate their way across the countryside, and were thought by many Indians to threaten an ancient society whose inmost structure and spirit sprang from a rigid and unalterable caste system. If everyone used the same trains and the same schools, or even the same roads, it was argued, how could caste survive? Indian monarchs were apprehensive and resentful of the recent annexations. Hatred smouldered at the repression of Sati. Unfounded stories spread that the government intended to convert India forcibly to Christianity. The disasters in Afghanistan and the slaughter of the Sikh wars cast doubt on the invincibility of British arms. Many of the sepoys, or Indian soldiers, considered themselves equal or superior to European troops. Thus a legacy of troubles confronted Dalhousie's successor, Lord Canning. He'd been in India little more than a year when the introduction of a new type of ammunition provided a spark and focus for the mass of discontent. In the year of the centenary of Plassey, rumours began to flow that the cartridges for the new Enfield rifle were greased with the fat of pigs and cows, animals which Muslim and Hindu respectively were forbidden to eat. The cartridges had to be bitten before they could be inserted in the muzzle. Thus, sepoys of both religions would be defiled. There was some truth in the story, for beef fat had been used in the London arsenal at Woolwich, though it was never used at the Indian factory at Dum Dum, and as soon as the complaints began, no tainted missiles were issued. Nevertheless, the tale ran through the regiments in the spring of 1857, and there was much unrest. In April, some cavalry troopers at Meerut were court-martialed and imprisoned for refusing to touch the cartridges, and on May the 9th, they were publicly stripped of their uniforms. An Indian officer told his superiors that the sepoys were planning to break open the jail and release the prisoners. His warning was disbelieved. Next night, three regiments mutinied, captured the prison, killed their British officers, and marched on Delhi. There was nothing at hand to stop them. South of the Punjab, fewer than 11 full-strength battalions and ancillary forces, comprising in all about 40,000 British soldiers, were scattered across the vast peninsula, and even these were not on a war footing. The Indian troops outnumbered them by 5 to 1 and had most of the artillery. The hot weather had started, distances were great, transport was scarce, the authorities were unprepared. Nevertheless, when the British power was so weak and India might have been plunged once again into the anarchy and bloodshed from which she'd been gradually and painfully rescued, most of the populace remained aloof and at peace, and none of the leading Indian rulers joined the revolt. Of the three armies maintained by the company, only one, that of Bengal, was affected. Gurkhas from Nepal helped to quell the rising. The Punjab remained loyal, and its Sikhs and Muslims respected the colours and disarmed wavering regiments. The valley of the Ganges was the centre of the turmoil. But at first, all went with a rush. The magazine at Delhi was guarded by 2 British officers and 6 soldiers. They fought to the last, and when resistance was hopeless, they blew it up. The mutineers killed every European in sight, seized the aged King of Delhi, now living in retirement as the company's pensioner, and proclaimed him Mughal Emperor. The appeal failed, and few Muslims rose to support it. For 3 weeks there was a pause, and then the mutiny spread. British officers would not believe in the disloyalty of their troops, and many were murdered. At Cawnpore, on the borders of Oudh, the garrison left the citadel to guard the road. They trusted to the loyalty of the Nana Sahib, the dispossessed adopted son of an Indian ruler, but still a powerful figure. They were mistaken, and a terrible fate was soon to befall them. At Lucknow, the capital, Henry Lawrence prepared the residency for what was to be a long and glorious defence. Meanwhile, rightly perceiving that the key to the revolt lay in Delhi, the British mustered such forces as they could and seized the ridge overlooking the city. There were too few to make an assault, and for weeks, in the height of summer, 3,000 troops, most of whom were British, held the 50-foot eminence against an enemy 20 or 30 times their number. Early in August, Nicholson arrived with reinforcements from the Punjab, having marched nearly 30 miles a day for 3 weeks. Thus animated, the British attacked on September the 14th, and after 6 days' street fighting, in which Nicholson was killed, the city fell. The poor king was sent to Burma. His 2 sons were taken prisoners and summarily shot after an attempt had been made to rescue them. This created a fresh grievance in Indian eyes. At Cawnpore, there was a horrible massacre. For 21 days, 900 British and loyal Indians, nearly half of them women and children, were besieged and attacked by 3,000 sepoys with a Nana Sahib at their head. At length, on June the 26th, they were granted safe conduct. As they were leaving by boat, they were fired upon, and all the men were killed. Such women and children as survived were cast into prison. On the night of July the 15th, a relieving force under Sir Henry Havelock, a veteran of Indian warfare, was barely 20 miles away. The Nana Sahib ordered his sepoys to kill the prisoners. They refused. 5 assassins then cut the captives to death with knives and threw the bodies into a well. 2 days later, Havelock arrived. "Had any Christian bishop visited that scene of butchery when I saw it," wrote an eyewitness long afterwards, "I verily believe that he would have buckled on his sword." Here and elsewhere, the British troops took horrible vengeance. Mutineers were blown from the mouths of cannon, sometimes alive, or their bodies sewn up in the skins of cows and swine. The rebels turned on Lucknow. Here also there was a desperate struggle. 1,700 troops, nearly half of them loyal sepoys, held the residency under Henry Lawrence against 60,000 rebels. For Inud, unlike most of India, the population joined the revolt. Food was short, and there was much disease. On September the 25th, Havelock and Outram fought their way in, but were beset in their turn, Havelock dying of exhaustion a few days later. In November, the siege was raised by Sir Colin Campbell, the new commander-in-chief appointed by Lord Palmerston. Campbell had seen service against Napoleon and had a distinguished record in the Crimean War. A fresh threat to Cawnpore compelled him to move on. Outram, reinforced, continued to hold out, and Lucknow was not finally liberated till the following March. No one knows what happened to the Nana Sahib. He disappeared forever into the Himalayan jungle. Elsewhere, the rising was more speedily crushed. The recapture of Delhi had destroyed all semblance and pretense that the mutiny was a national revolt. Fighting, sporadic but often fierce, continued in the central provinces until the end of 1858. But on November the 1st, the Governor-General, Clemency Canning, derisively so called for his mercifulness, proclaimed with truth that Queen Victoria was now sovereign of all India. The first viceroy, as Canning became, was a son of the renowned Foreign Secretary and Prime Minister. The rule of the East India Company, which had long ceased to be a trading business in India, was abolished. This was the work of the short Conservative government of Derby and Disraeli. Thus, after almost exactly a century, the advice which Clive had given to Pitt was accepted by the British government. Henceforward, there were to be no more annexations, no subsidiary treaties, no more civil wars. Religious toleration and equality before the law were promised to all. Indians, for a generation and more, were to look back on the Queen's proclamation of 1858 as a Magna Carta. The scale of the Indian mutiny should not be exaggerated. Three-quarters of the troops remained loyal. Barely a third of British territory was affected. There had been risings and revolts among the soldiery before. The brunt of the outbreak was suppressed in the space of a few weeks. It was in no sense a national movement, or, as some later Indian writers have suggested, a patriotic struggle for freedom or a war of independence. The idea and ideal of the inhabitants of the subcontinent forming a single people and state was not to emerge for many years. But terrible atrocities had been committed by both sides. From now on, there was an increasing gulf between the rulers and the ruled. The easygoing ways of the 18th century were gone forever, and so were the missionary fervour and reforming zeal of the early Victorians and their predecessors. The English no longer looked on India as home, or themselves as crusaders called to redeem and uplift the great multitudes. British administration became detached, impartial, efficient. Great progress was made, and many material benefits were secured. The frontiers were guarded, and the peace was kept. Starvation was subdued. The population vastly increased. The Indian Army, revived and reorganized, was to play a glorious part on Britain's side in two world wars. Nevertheless, the atrocities and reprisals of the blood-stained months of the mutiny left an enduring and bitter mark in the memory of both countries. While these events unrolled in India, the political scene in England remained confused. Issues were not clear-cut. Peel's conversion to free trade had destroyed the party lines which he'd done so much to draw, and for 20 years in Britain, governments of mixed complexion followed one another. Disraeli and Derby, having broken Peel, found that it took a long time to muster the remnant of the former Tory protectionists into an effective political party. Rising men like Gladstone, who remained faithful to the Peel tradition, would have nothing to do with them, though on at least one occasion Disraeli tried hard to enlist Gladstone's cooperation. It is an interesting speculation what might have happened had these two bitter opponents and future prime ministers at this stage joined hands. The Whigs, under Russell and Palmerston, felt that their main aims had already been accomplished. Palmerston was willing to make improvements in government, but large-scale changes were not to his mind. Russell hankered after a further measure of electoral reform, but that was the limit of his programme. Both conceived of themselves as guardians of the system that they had the fortune to head. In this attitude, the two leaders, and Palmerston especially, were probably in harmony with mid-Victorian opinion. Radicalism in these years made little appeal to the voters. Prosperity was spreading through the land, and with it went a lull in the fiercer forms of political agitation. Dignity and deference were the values of the age. If the gentleman was still the admired ideal, the self-made man was also deeply respected. The doctrine of industrious self-help, preached by Samuel Smiles, was widely popular in the middle classes and among many artisans as well. The lessons of the Chartist failure had been learnt, and educating the manual labourer began to seem more important than rousing him to revolution. With this view, large numbers of working men happily concurred. All this made for a feeling of stability, with which a sense of steady progress was allied. Religion, in its numerous varieties, cast a soothing and uplifting influence on men's minds. Many millions, more than half the total population, were regular attenders at church or chapel, though churchgoers were fewer among the very poor. Religious debate was earnest, sometimes acrimonious, but the contests it bred were verbal. Civil strife for the sake of religion was a thing of the past. The virtues of toleration had been learnt, though toleration did not mean lukewarmness. The churches and sects and their flocks took leave to disapprove of one another, occasionally with vigour. When the Roman Catholic Church re-established its hierarchy of bishops in England, there was vehement commotion and protest in London, but nothing amounting to riot. The Church of England, earlier in the century, had been stirred from slumber by evangelical zeal and the lofty ideals of the Oxford movement. The Low Church and High Church parties, as they were called, strove eloquently for men's souls. About half the churchgoers of England were members of the Anglican Communion. Dissent also flourished, and Methodist, Baptist, Presbyterian, Congregational, and Unitarian preachers gained a wide allegiance. The Church of Rome in England had revived under the impulse of Catholic emancipation and was reinforced by the accession of a number of high Anglican clergy, including John Henry Newman, a profound and subtle thinker, later created a cardinal. Religious preoccupations were probably more widespread and deeply felt than at any time since the days of Cromwell. But thinking men were also disturbed by a new theory, long foreshadowed in the work of scientists, the theory of evolution. It was given classic expression in The Origin of Species, published by Charles Darwin in 1859. This book provoked doubt and perplexity among those who could no longer take literally the biblical account of creation. But the theory of evolution, and its emphasis on the survival of the fittest in the history of life upon the globe, was a powerful adjunct to mid-Victorian optimism. It lent fresh force to the belief in the forward march of mankind. Palmerston seemed to his fellow countrymen the embodiment of their own healthy hopes. He'd lost none of his old vigour in chastising foreign governments, and his patriotic sentiments appealed to the self-confidence of the nation. They did not always appeal to the Queen and Prince Albert, who resented his habit of sending off sharply worded dispatches without consulting them. But it was Palmerston's desire, for all his strong language and sometimes hasty action, to keep the general peace in Europe. For this reason, the liberal movements in foreign countries which engaged his sympathy also sometimes gave him reason for anxiety. The greatest of the European movements in these years was the cause of Italian unity. This long-cherished dream of the Italian peoples was at last realized, though only partially, in 1859 and 1860. The story is well known of how the Italians secured the military aid of Napoleon III for the price of ceding Nice and Savoy to France, and how, after winning Lombardy from the Austrians, the French emperor left his allies in the lurch. Venice remained unredeemed. Still worse, a French army protected the rump of the Papal State in Rome, and for 10 years deprived the Italians of their natural capital. But as one small Italian state after another cast out their alien rulers and merged under a single monarchy, widespread enthusiasm was aroused in England. Garibaldi and his 1,000 volunteers, who overturned the detested Bourbon government in Sicily and Naples with singular dash and speed, were acclaimed as heroes in London. These bold events were welcome to Palmerston and his Foreign Secretary, Russell. At the same time, the British leaders were suspicious of Napoleon III's designs and fearful of a wider war. Congratulation but non-intervention was therefore their policy. It is typical of these two old Whigs that they applauded the new Italian government for putting into practice the principles of the English Revolution of 1688. Russell in the House of Commons compared Garibaldi to King William III. History does not relate what the Italians made of this. In home politics, meanwhile, a sublime complacency enveloped the government. Palmerston, like Melbourne before him, did not believe in too much legislation. Good humour and common sense distinguished him. As the novelist Trollope well said, he was a statesman for the moment. Whatever was not wanted now, whatever was not practicable now, he drove quite out of his mind. This practical outlook found no favour among the younger and more thrusting members of the House of Commons. Disraeli, chafing on the opposition benches, vented his scorn and irritation on this last of the 18th-century politicians. "His external system," he once told the House, "is turbulent and aggressive, that his rule at home may be tranquil and unassailed. Hence arise excessive expenditure, heavy taxation, and the stoppage of all social improvement. His scheme of conduct is so devoid of all political principle that when forced to appeal to the people, his only claim to their confidence is his name." Peel's disciples and followers were no less despairing and powerless. So long as leadership remained in the hands of Palmerston, Russell, and the Whig nobility, there could be little hope of advance towards the liberalism of which they dreamed. "The Whigs," said Sidney Herbert at a moment when they were temporarily out of office, "are incurable in their superstitions about ducal houses. I see no prospect of the formation of an efficient party, let alone government, out of the chaos on the opposition benches. No one reigns over or in it but discord and antipathy. The aristocratic Whigs seem to be nearly used up, and the party produces no new men, but at the same time complains of the old ones. Middle-aged merchants, shrewd men of business, feel their vanity hurt that they have not the refusal of office." The Tories were little better off. Their nominal head was Lord Derby, who could be brilliant in debate, but was apt to regard politics as an unpleasant duty imposed upon the members of his class. His real interest lay in horse racing, and he also produced an excellent translation of Homer. Disraeli had become the leader of his party in the House of Commons. His struggle for power was hard and uphill. A Jew at the head of a phalanx of country gentlemen was an unusual sight in English politics. After the repeal of the Corn Laws, protection was not only dead, but, as Disraeli himself said, damned, and he and Derby had agreed to discard it as a party principle. But the search for a new theme was long, painful, and frustrating. Meanwhile, he had to play the part of Derby's lieutenant, and their spells of office in 1852 and 1858 were brief and uneventful. Disraeli more than once sought an alliance with the Radicals, and promised them that he would oppose armaments and an aggressive foreign policy. Colonies, he even declared, were a millstone round our necks. But their chief spokesman, John Bright, was under no illusions. The shrewd Quaker was not to be caught. "Mr. Disraeli," he said, "is a man who does what may be called the conjuring for his party. He is what among a tribe of Red Indians would be called the medicine man." And that was the end of that. Thus foiled, Disraeli returned to his attack on the Whigs. He was convinced that the only way to destroy them was by extending the franchise yet further, so as to embrace the respectable artisans and counter the hostility of the middle classes. Patiently he worked on Derby and his colleagues. In his youth, he dreamed of uniting the two nations, the rich and the poor, as the world of his novel Sybil shows, and the 1850s saw the slow emergence of a practical doctrine of Tory democracy. But Disraeli's ideas took time to find acceptance. Standing apart, both from the Whigs and Derby's Tories, were the Peelites, of whom the most notable was William Gladstone. Having started his parliamentary career in 1832 as a strict Tory, he was to make a long pilgrimage into the Liberal camp. The death of Peel had destroyed his allegiance to Toryism, and he too was in search of a new theme. The son of a rich Liverpool merchant with slave-owning interests in the West Indies, Gladstone came from the same class as his old leader, and believed, like him, in the new arguments for free trade. Though admired as an administrator and an orator, his contemporaries considered him wanting in judgment and principle. But in fact, as Palmerston perceived, he was awaking to the political potentialities of the English middle class. He might, he said, be called one of the people. He wished to identify himself with them. He possessed religious enthusiasm and made it powerful over others from the force of his own intellect. Despite his preoccupations with theology, he comprehended the minds of the new voters better than his colleagues, and understood the workings of party better than Peel. Oxford on the surface, but Liverpool underneath. Such was a contemporary judgment. But, like Disraeli, his progress was slow. He was Chancellor of the Exchequer at the beginning of the Crimean War. Then he faded into opposition. It was fortunate for him that supreme power did not come too soon. Peel had been frustrated by early experience of high office, which prevented him from putting his ideas to the test. Long years of waiting made Gladstone sure of himself. In 1859, aged nearly 50, Gladstone joined the Whigs, and the pilgrimage was over. His decision was made on an issue of foreign policy, but he again concentrated on finance. As Chancellor of the Exchequer under Palmerston, his golden period began. Great budget speeches in the House of Commons, a superb handling of administrative detail, a commercial treaty with France which opened a new era in free trade, and demands for retrenchment in military affairs, which brought him into conflict with his Prime Minister. His finance was a remarkable success. Three brilliant budgets reduced taxation. Trade was rapidly expanding, and it was soon apparent who would succeed to the leadership of the party. In 1865, in his 81st year, Palmerston died. "Gladstone," he declared in his last days, "will soon have it all his own way, and whenever he gets my place, we shall have strange doings." The old Whig was right. The 18th century died with him. The later Victorian age demanded a new leader, and at long last he had arrived. When Gladstone next appeared before his electors, he opened his speech by saying, "At last, my friends, I am come among you, and I am come among you unmuzzled." But the Whigs still hesitated. Gladstone, like Disraeli, wanted to extend the franchise to large sections of the working classes. He was anxious to capture the votes of the new electorate. He prevailed upon the government, now headed by Russell, to put forward a reform bill. But it was defeated on an amendment, and the cabinet resigned. Minority administrations under Derby and Disraeli followed, which lasted for 2.5 years. Disraeli now seized his chance. He introduced a fresh reform bill in 1867, which he skillfully adapted to meet the wishes of the House, of which he was leader. There was a redistribution of seats in favour of the large industrial towns, and nearly 1 million new voters were added to an existing electorate of about the same number. The Tories were nervous at this startling advance from their original plan. In many towns, the working classes would now be in the majority at elections. Derby called it a leap in the dark. The recent civil war in America seemed a poor recommendation for democracy, and even the radicals were anxious about how the uneducated masses would behave. But this immediately became clear. The carrying of the second reform bill, so soon after the death of Palmerston, opened a new era in English politics. New issues and new methods began to emerge. As Walter Bagehot, the banker and economist, said, "A political country is like an American forest. You have only to cut down the old trees, and immediately new trees come up to replace them." In February 1868, Derby resigned from the leadership of the party, and Disraeli was at last Prime Minister. As he put it, "at the top of the greasy pole." He had to hold a general election. The new voters gave their overwhelming support to his opponents, and Gladstone, who'd become leader of the Liberal Party, formed the strongest administration that England had seen since the days of Peel. Chapter 6. The Migration of the Peoples. 1. Canada and South Africa. Occupation of the empty lands of the globe was vehemently accelerated by the fall of Napoleon. The long struggle against France had stifled or arrested the expansion of the English-speaking peoples, and the ships and the men who might have founded the Second British Empire had been consumed in 20 years of world war. A generation of men and women had toiled or fought in their factories or on their farms, in the fleets and in the armies, and only a very few had had either the wish or the opportunity to seek a new life and new fortunes overseas. Their energies and their hopes had been concentrated on survival and on victory. There'd been no time for dreams of emigration, and no men to spare if it had been possible. Suddenly, all this was changed by the decision at Waterloo. Once again, the oceans were free. No enemies threatened in Europe. Ships need no longer sail in convoy, and the main outlines of the continents had been charted. Once more, the new world offered an escape from the hardships and frustrations of the old. The war was over. Fares were cheap and transport was plentiful. The result was the most spectacular migration of human beings of which history has yet had record, and a vast enrichment of the trade and industry of Great Britain. Of course, the process took time to gather way, and at first the flow of emigrants was very small. But the road had been pointed by the grim convict settlements in Australia, by the loyalists from the United States who'd moved to Canada, and by traders, explorers, missionaries, and whalers all over the temperate zones of the earth. News began to spread among the masses that fertile, unoccupied, and habitable lands still existed, in which white men could dwell in peace and liberty, and perhaps could even better themselves. The increasing population of Great Britain added to the pressure. In 1801 it was about 11 millions. 30 years later it was 16 millions, and by 1871 it was 10 millions more. Fewer people died at birth or in early childhood, and it has been established by recent authority that, despite the Industrial Revolution, London was a healthier place to live in than rural Prussia or Bourbon Paris. The numbers grew, and the flow began. In the 1820s, 250,000 emigrants. In the 1830s, 500,000. By the middle of the century, 1.5 million, until 65 years after Waterloo, no fewer than 8 million people had left the British Isles. The motives, methods, and character of the movement were very different from those which had sustained the Pilgrim Fathers and the Stuart plantations of the 17th century. Famine drove at least 1 million Irishmen to the United States and elsewhere. Gold lured hardy fortune hunters to Australia and to the bleak recesses of Canada, where they discovered a more practical, if less respectable, El Dorado than had dazzled the Elizabethan adventurers. Hunger for land and for the profits of the wool trade beckoned the more sober and well-to-do. All this was largely accomplished in the face of official indifference and sometimes of hostility. The American War of Independence had convinced most of the ruling classes in Britain that colonies were undesirable possessions. They did not even have a departmental secretary of state of their own until 1854. The government was interested in strategic bases, but if ordinary people wanted to settle in the new lands, then let them do so. It might cure unemployment and provide posts for penniless noblemen. But the sooner these communities became completely independent, the better, and cheaper for the taxpayer in England. Anyway, Greece was more interesting news than New Zealand, and the educated public were much more concerned about the slave trade than the squalors of the emigrant ships. Thus, as in India, the second British Empire was founded almost by accident, and with small encouragement from any of the main political parties. Of the new territories, Canada was the most familiar and the nearest in point of distance to the United Kingdom. Her maritime provinces had long sent timber to Britain, and rather than return with empty holds, the shipowners were content to transport emigrants for a moderate fare. Once they landed, however, the difficulties and the distances were very great. The maritime provinces lived a life very much of their own, and many emigrants chose to push on into Lower Canada, or, as it's now called, the province of Quebec. Pitt, in 1791, had sought to solve the racial problems of Canada by dividing her into two parts. In Lower Canada, the French were deeply rooted, a compact, alien community led by priests and seigneurs, uninterested and untouched by the democratic ideas of liberal or revolutionary Europe, and holding stubbornly, like the Boers in South Africa, to their own traditions and language. Beyond them, to the northwest, lay Upper Canada, the modern province of Ontario, settled by some of the 60,000 Englishmen who'd left the United States towards the end of the 18th century, rather than live under the American Republic. These proud folk had, out of devotion to the British throne, abandoned most of their possessions, and been rewarded with the unremunerative but honourable title of United Empire Loyalists. The Mohawk tribe, inspired by the same sentiments, had journeyed with them. They had hacked a living space out of the forests, and dwelt lonely and remote, cut off from Lower Canada by the rapids of the St. Lawrence, and watchful against incursions from the United States. Then there was a vast emptiness till one reached a few posts on the Pacific, which traded their wares to China. These communities, so different in tradition, character, and race, had been rallied into temporary unity by invasion from the United States. French, English, and Red Indians all fought against the Americans, and repulsed them in the 3-year struggle between 1812 and 1814. Then trouble began. The French in Lower Canada feared that the immigrants would outnumber and dominate them. The Loyalists in Upper Canada welcomed new settlers, who would increase the price of land, but were reluctant to treat them as equals. Moreover, the two provinces started to quarrel with each other. Upper Canada's external trade had to pass through Lower Canada and there pay taxes, and disputes occurred about sharing the proceeds. Differences over religion added to the irritations. From about 1820, the assembly in Lower Canada began to behave like the parliaments of the early Stuarts and the legislatures of the American colonies, refusing to vote money for the salaries of royal judges and permanent officials. French politicians made vehement speeches. In Upper Canada, the new settlers struggled for political equality with the Loyalists. Liberals wanted to make the executive responsible to the assembly and talked wildly of leaving the empire. And in 1836, the assembly in which they held a majority was dissolved. In the following year, both provinces rebelled. Lower Canada for a month, and Upper Canada for a week. There were mobs, firing by troops, shifty compromises, and very few executions. Everything was on a small scale and in a minor key, and no great harm was done. But it made the British government realise that Canadian affairs required attention. The Whig leaders in London were wiser than George III. They perceived that a tiny minority of insurgents could lead to great troubles, and in 1838 Lord Durham was sent to investigate, assisted by Edward Gibbon Wakefield. His instructions were vague and simple, to put things right. And meanwhile, the Canadian Constitution was suspended by Act of Parliament. Durham was a radical, brilliant, decisive, and hot-tempered. Wakefield was an active theorist on imperial affairs whose misconduct with a couple of heiresses had earned him a prison sentence and compelled him to spend the rest of his public life behind the scenes. Durham stayed only a few months. His high-handed conduct in dealing with disaffected Canadians aroused much criticism of him at Westminster. Feeling himself deserted by Lord Melbourne's government, with which he was personally unpopular, but which should nevertheless have stood by him, Durham resigned and returned to England. He then produced the famous report in which he diagnosed and proclaimed the root causes of the trouble, and advocated responsible government carried on by ministers commanding the confidence of the popular assembly, a united Canada, and planned settlements of the unoccupied lands. These recommendations were largely put into effect by the Canada Act of 1840, which was the work of Lord John Russell. Thereafter, Canada's progress was swift and peaceful. Her population had risen from about 500,000 in 1815 to 1.25 million in 1838. A regular steamship service with the British Isles and cheap transatlantic postage were established in the same year. There were hesitations and doubts in England at the novel idea of making colonies almost completely free and allowing their democratic assemblies to choose and eject their own ministers, but the appointment of Durham's son-in-law, Lord Elgin, as Governor-General in 1847 was decisive. Elgin believed, like Durham, that the governor should represent the sovereign and remain in the background of politics. He appointed and dismissed ministers according to the wishes of the assembly. For this he was blamed or applauded, and even pelted with eggs and stones according to how it pleased or angered either side. But when he laid down his office 7 years later, the principle had been firmly accepted by Canadians of all persuasions that popular power must march with popular responsibility, that ministers must govern and be obeyed so long as they enjoyed the confidence of the majority, and should resign when they'd lost it. There was hardly any talk now of leaving the empire, or dividing Canada into separate and sovereign units, or joining the American Republic. On the contrary, The Oregon Treaty with the United States in 1846 extended the 49th parallel right across the continent as a boundary between the two countries, and gave the whole of Vancouver Island to Great Britain. How the treaty was concluded is related elsewhere in this volume. In the mid-century, a movement for the federation of all the Canadian provinces began to grow and gather support. The Civil War in the United States helped to convince Canadians that all was not perfect in their neighbor's constitution. And the victory of the North also aroused their fears that the exultant Union might be tempted to extend its borders farther still. Canada had already turned her gaze westwards. Between the province of Ontario and the Rocky Mountains lay 1,000 miles of territory, uninhabited save by a few settlers in Manitoba, a roaming place for Indians, trappers, and wild animals. It was a temptation, so it was argued, to the land hunger of the United States. Discharged Irish soldiers from the Civil War had already made armed raids across the border, which Congress had declared itself powerless to arrest. Might not the Americans press forward, occupy these vacant lands by stealth, and even establish a kind of squatter's right to the prairies? The soil was believed to be fertile and was said to offer a living for white men. In 1867, America purchased the remote and forbidding expanse of Alaska from the Russians for the sum of $7,200,000. But here, on the doorstep of the Republic, lay a prize which seemed much more desirable and was very easy of access. No one ruled over it except the Hudson's Bay Company, founded in the reign of Charles II, and the company, believing that agriculture would imperil its fur trade, was both hostile to settlers and jealous of its own authority. 11 years before, however, the discovery of gold on the Fraser River had precipitated a rush of fortune hunters to the Pacific coast. The company's officials had proved powerless to control the turmoil, and the government in London had been compelled to extend the royal sovereignty to this distant shore. Thus was born the Crown Colony of British Columbia, which soon united with the island of Vancouver and demanded and obtained self-rule. But between it and Ontario lay a no-man's land, and something must be done if it was not to fall into the hands of the United States. How, indeed, could Canada remain separate from America and yet stay alive? These considerations prompted the British North America Act of 1867, which created the first of the self-governing British dominions beyond the seas. The provinces of Ontario, Quebec, New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia were the founding members. They adopted a federal constitution of a very different shape from that of the United States. All powers not expressly reserved to the provinces of Canada were assumed by the central government. The Governor-General, representing the monarch, ruled through ministers drawn from the majority in her Canadian House of Commons, and members of the House were elected in numbers proportionate to the population they represented. Thus the way was made easy for the absorption of new territories and provinces, and on the eve of her railway age and westward expansion, the political stability of Canada was assured. When the Parliament of the New Dominion first met, its chief anxiety was about the western lands. Its members looked to the future, and it is convenient here to chart the results of their foresight. The obvious, immediate step was to buy out the Hudson's Bay Company. This was done 2 years later for the sum of £300,000. The company kept its trading rights, and indeed retains them to this day, but it surrendered its territorial sovereignty to the Crown. The process was not accomplished without bloodshed. There was a brief revolt in Manitoba, where wild Indian half-breeds thought that their freedom was endangered. But order was soon restored. Manitoba became a province of the Dominion in 1870, and in the next year, British Columbia was also admitted. By themselves, however, these constitutional steps would not have sufficed to bind the broad stretches of Canada together. The challenging task that faced the Dominion was to settle and develop her empty western lands before the immigrant tide from America could flood across the 49th parallel. The answer was to build a transcontinental railway. When the Maritime Provinces joined the Federation, they'd done so on condition they were linked with Ontario by rail, and after 9 years of labour, a line was completed in 1876. British Columbia made the same demand and received the same promise. It proved much more difficult to fulfil. Capital was scarce, investors were timid, politics were tangled, and much of the country was unknown. At length, however, a Scotsman, Donald Smith, better known as Lord Strathcona, carried out the plan. His company demanded 10 years. Helped by government funds, they finished their work in half the time, and the Canadian Pacific Railway was opened in 1885. Other lines sprang up, and corn, soon counted in millions of bushels a year, began to flow in from the prairies. Canada had become a nation, and shining prospects lay before her. South Africa, unlike America, had scanty attractions for the early colonists and explorers. As the halfway house to the Indies, many broke their voyage there, but few cared to stay. The Gulf of St. Lawrence made it easy to reach the interior of Canada, but the coastline of South Africa, short of natural harbours and navigable rivers, mostly consisted of cliffs and sandhills washed by strong currents and stormy seas. Inland, a succession of mountain ranges running parallel to the coast barred the way. From the west, the ascent was comparatively gradual, but the country was barren and waterless. From the south and east, range after range, in many places sheer and precipitous, had to be climbed. Few lands have been more difficult for Europeans to enter than South Africa, and for them it long remained the Tavern of the Seas, a port of call on the route to the east. In the 17th century, the fleets of the Dutch East India Company, sailing for the Indies or returning home to Amsterdam and Rotterdam, were the most frequent visitors to the Cape, and Table Bay was their halting place. The establishment of a permanent settlement was discussed, but nothing was done till 1652, when, at the height of their power and in the golden age of their civilization, the Dutch sent Jan van Riebeck, a young ship surgeon, with 3 ships to take possession of Table Bay. Colonization was no part of the plan. They merely wanted to found a port of call for the company's ships, and almost all the inhabitants were servants of the company, forbidden to strike out into the new land. After 20 years, there were no more than 64 free burghers at Table Bay. The change came at the turn of the 17th century under the governorship of Simon van der Stel and his son William Adrian. They encouraged settlers to come out from Holland and take up grants of land, and by 1707 there were over 1,500 free burghers. Not all were Dutch. Many were Huguenots, Germans or Swedes, driven into exile by religious persecution. But the Dutch gradually assimilated them. The little community was served and sustained by a local population of Negro slaves. Throughout the 18th century, the colony prospered and grew. In 1760, the first European crossed the Orange River, and by 1778, the Fish River had been made its eastern boundary. By the end of the century, the population numbered about 15,000, and there were 3 areas of settlement. Cape Town, or Little Paris, as the settlers called it, was a town and port of 5,000 inhabitants and the company's headquarters. The agricultural coast belt near the Cape Peninsula offered the farmers a limited prosperity, and life was easy though primitive. Finally, there was the inland plateau and remoter coast belt, where dwelt the frontiersmen, restless, hard, self-reliant, narrow-minded, isolated from society, and impatient of the restraints of civilized government, the forerunners of the Trekkers and the Transvaal Boers of the 19th century. But Holland had now been slowly overtaken by Britain, and as the century drew to its close, it became clear that the imperial future lay not with the Dutch, but either with the British or the French. Napoleon's wars ruined the Dutch trade, swept the Dutch ships from the seas, and overthrew the Dutch state. In 1782, the Dutch East India Company had paid its last dividend, and 12 years later declared its bankruptcy, with a deficit of £10 million. The consequences were serious. Holland had no longer the power to protect her possessions, and when the Dutch were defeated by the French and the puppet state of the Batavian Republic was established, the British seized Cape Colony as enemy territory. It was finally ceded to them under the peace settlement of 1814 in return for an indemnity of £6 million. At first they met with no great hostility. The Dutch company had been unpopular, there was no deliberate policy of Anglicization, and the Cape kept most of its Dutch customs and traditions. The British dealt forcefully with the eastern frontier, where the settlers were in contact and conflict with the great southward migration of the Bantu peoples from Central Africa. This extended right across the continent, from the Hereros and Damaras in the west to the Nguni coast peoples in the east. There was much cattle raiding along the line of the Fish River, and fighting between the Dutch and the natives had broken out in 1779. Thus began a long succession of Kaffir wars lasting for 100 years. The settlers, scattered in isolated farms over vast stretches of country, found it difficult to defend themselves and had demanded help from Cape Town. The faraway Dutch authorities had given them no support. It was now the turn of the British. They decided that the only way to secure the line of the Fish River was to colonize the border with British settlers, and between 1820 and 1821 nearly 5,000 of them were brought out from Great Britain. This emigration coincided with a change of policy. Convinced that South Africa was now destined to become a permanent part of the British Empire, the government resolved to make it as English as they could. English began to replace Dutch as the official language. In 1828, the judicial system was remodeled on the English pattern, Dutch currency was replaced by English, and the English began to dominate the churches and the schools. Thus was born a division which Canada had surmounted. With the same religion, a similar language, a common stock, and kindred political and social traditions, British and Boers nevertheless plunged into racial strife. British methods of government created among the Boers a more bitter antagonism than in any other imperial country except Ireland. Anglicization was not only ill-conceived, it was unsuccessful. The English were to discover, as the Spaniards had learnt in the 16th century, that no race has ever clung more tenaciously to its own culture and institutions than the Dutch. And the only result of the new policy in the 1820s and 1830s was to harden those differences of opinion, especially on the native question, which were already beginning to appear. At this time, there was much enthusiasm in England for good works, and English missionaries had been active in South Africa since the early years of the century. The missionaries believed and preached that black men were the equals of white men. The settlers regarded the natives primarily as farmhands and wanted to control them as strictly as possible. When the missionaries got slavery abolished in 1833, the settlers were indignant at such interference, which meant scarcity of labour, a weakening of their authority and prestige, a risk that large numbers of the Bantu would become beggars and vagrants. At first the English settlers agreed with the Dutch, but as soon as the influence of the missionaries, especially Dr. John Philip and the London Missionary Society, came to sway the government and the colonial office, the Dutch were left alone to nurse their grievances against the English authorities. The first crisis came in 1834. The settlement of the Fish River area brought no security, and hordes of Bantu swept over the frontier, laying waste the country and destroying the farms. The governor, Sir Benjamin Durban, drove them back, and to prevent another attack, he annexed the territory between the rivers Keeskamma and Kay, expelled the native raiders, and compensated the settlers by offering them land in this new province, which was named after Queen Adelaide. This roused the missionaries, and they persuaded the colonial secretary, Lord Glenelg, to repudiate Durban and abandon the new province. The settlers lost all compensation, and insult was added to injury when it became known that Glenelg considered that the Kaffirs had an ample justification for the war into which they had rushed. Thus was provoked the Great Trek. In small parties, accompanied by their women and children, and driving their cattle before them, about 5,000 Boers set out into the unknown, like the children of Israel seeking the promised land. They were soon followed by many others. Some journeyed over 1,000 miles to the banks of the Limpopo. Many were attacked by the Matabele and the Zulu. All endured thirst and famine. Yet in the unyielding spirit of their Calvinist religion, they marched on. The Great Trek was one of the remarkable feats of the 19th century, and its purpose was to shake off British rule forever. "We quit this colony," wrote Peter Retief, one of the Boer leaders, "under the full assurance that the English government has nothing more to require of us, and will allow us to govern ourselves without its interference in future." For long their fortunes looked dark. It was the time of the Mfecane, the crushing of the other native tribes by the military empire of the Zulus under Chaka and his successor Dingaan. The Zulu massacre of thousands of natives gave the Boers room to move, but they moved in great peril. In many lonely places within the laager of their ox wagons, they faced the wild onslaught of the Zulu warriors. And not until December 1838 did they crush Dingaan's forces in a great battle at Blood River. After their victory, they established the Republic of Natal around the little town of Pietermaritzburg, with Andries Pretorius as its first president. Their freedom was brief. The British refused to recognize the Republic, and after a short struggle in 1845, made it a province of Cape Colony. There remained the Four Trekkers on the plateau farther west, now reinforced by many refugees from Natal. Here, too, the British intervened. In 1848, Sir Harry Smith, a brave and energetic soldier who'd served under Wellington, annexed the country between the Orange and the Vaal rivers, defeated Pretorius at Boomplatz, and left only scattered Boer settlements across the Vaal outside the colony. Soon afterwards, there was trouble with the tribes beyond the Orange River, and in particular with the Basuto. In Natal, the problem had been met by creating native reserves and re-establishing the old tribal hierarchies under the indirect supervision of the government. But the government in London